This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. It's the day after Christmas, and while Santa did not bring a fiscal cliff solution, the president says he thinks there is still a chance. It's Wednesday, and time for a
hopeless optimist
edition of The Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
Oops.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to recap the week in politics, and the countdown continues. In just a week, the country will topple over the fiscal cliff if lawmakers and the administration do not reach an agreement on tax and spending reforms. Republican Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho was charged with drunk driving over the holidays. He's a Mormon who says he doesn't drink. And the NRA sparks a backlash after the Newtown tragedy with their proposal to put armed guards in schools. In just a moment, we'll review highlights from the year in politics. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Ari. And, by the way, this could make or break your career.
Thank you. Well, fortunately, it's the day after Christmas, so not many people are listening, I'm told.
Everybody's listening.
Well, Ken, as always, we begin with a trivia question. What have you got for us?
Okay, well, Mark Sanford, he's the former governor of South Carolina who left office in, shall we say, disgrace. He said he's thinking about running for the House seat about to be vacated by soon-to-be Senator Tim Scott. So the trivia question is, who was the last former governor to run for the House?
Okay, if you think you know the answer and you have not won in the last 6 months, give us a call. The number is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And the winner gets a fabulous Political Junkie T-shirt.
Oh, my God.
And the no prize button.
Ugh.
So, Ken, to the week in politics. The president's coming back. Lawmakers are coming back to work on this fiscal cliff, single-digit days left to reach an agreement. Where do things stand?
Well, with all respect to the late Dick Clark, it feels like he's doing a countdown on New Year's Eve. There are 6 days to go, and it looks like both sides are not coming close at all to any kind of an agreement. Obviously, Speaker Boehner's plan B that he wanted to put on the floor for a vote last week that would tax people who have incomes over $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even have Republican support for that.
So it was a more conservative plan, but not conservative enough for his own party.
There are some Republicans who say no taxes, period. So whether it's $250,000 or $1 million, we're still not voting for higher taxes.
So any hope of a solution?
Well, it looks like, I mean, something has got to happen. It looks like President Obama is coming back, is cutting short his Hawaii vacation, coming back early. He'll be back in D.C. tomorrow. House and Senate come back into Washington tomorrow. It looks like they're going to have a vote on, perhaps, on the tax vote, that those making incomes of $250,000 or less will have those Bush tax cuts stay in place.
But is this just to look like they're doing something as the days tick down? Is there any real chance of a really big deal?
No, not a big deal before, but certainly. But what they don't want taxes to rise, and they don't want unemployment benefits. They don't want that to end as well. So Obama is basically saying that, okay, we'll have a short term fix, which is very popular in Washington these days or these years, and then we'll eventually hold off on the draconian spending cuts and tax increases, and we'll talk about that in the new year.
Okay. Now, the trivia question dealt with Mark Sanford, who may run for office in South Carolina. Let's talk about a few of these openings in the House and Senate that are coming up. What's happening in South Carolina?
Well, this is one, of course, because Jim DeMint announced that he's going to resign from the Senate, the very powerful conservative senator, a two-term senator who's going to become the head of the Heritage Foundation, and he'll probably resign January 2nd. Tim Scott, now soon to be the only African-American Republican in Congress, has been appointed by Governor Nikki Haley to fill that Senate seat. So there'll be an opening in the 1st Congressional District in South Carolina. Mark Sanford, who held that seat for three terms until he was elected governor in 2002, says, well, you know, something, I'm really thinking about it. Now, of course, he did leave office in disgrace. He was censured by the state legislature. He had this affair, not on the Appalachian Trail, of course, but with his soulmate, not in South Korea, but the other soulmate.
The other kind of soul.
The other soul, thank you. Okay. And Neil, by the way, Neil Cunningham usually laughs at those jokes.
And he has a different sense of humor.
Yes, he does. But also, the interesting thing is Jenny Sanford, Mark Sanford's former right. wife, is among those who said, well, I might be thinking about running for
so
that.
So it could be Sanford versus Sanford.
Or Sanford versus
Okay, so
son.
Speaking of Sanford, your trivia question, who is the last former governor to run for the House? We have Justin from Newark, New Jersey on the line. Justin, what do you think the answer is?
Tommy Thompson.
Ken?
Well, Tommy Thompson, actually, he was former governor, and he ran for the Senate this year, but he didn't run for the House. Actually, early in his career, he did run for the House, but well before he was governor.
Okay, well, let's see if we've got a right answer out there. But meanwhile, there are other openings. Senator Daniel Inouye was laid to rest in Hawaii this week. President Obama was at the memorial service. Where does that leave his seat?
Well, there could be a successor announced as soon as this week. By all accounts, Colleen Hanabusa, who is the most senior member of the congressional delegation in Hawaii, and that's all of 2 years. She was first elected in 2010. Daniel Inouye, in a letter to the governor, Neil Abercrombie, said, I would love for Hanabusa to be my successor. He wrote that shortly before he died. And the looks like the governor will name a successor within the next day or two, and it's most likely to be Colleen Hanabusa, a member of the House. Also leaving, of course, is Daniel Akaka, the only palindrome in the Senate. And also, that's 72 years of seniority that Hawaii is losing,
wow.
Both Inouye and Akaka.
And then the opening that is probably getting the most attention right now in the state of Massachusetts.
Right.
Senator John Kerry moves to, presumably, assuming he's confirmed, to be Secretary of State.
Well, the Republicans said from the beginning when they were campaigning against Susan Rice, they said, why not pick John Kerry? He'll sail through confirmation, and it looks like that'll happen. The president has nominated John Kerry. It looks like he will be sail through, and then, of course, there'll be an opening in the Senate. The last time that happened was, of course, when Ted Kennedy died, and there was an opening, and Scott Brown, the Republican, won that. Now, Scott Brown may or may not run again for that seat again, but there are a lot of Democrats who say, we're not going to make the same mistake we made in 2010. Remember, in 2010, Obama was unpopular, the Democrats were unpopular. It was perfect for timing for Scott Brown, and the Democratic candidate was a terrible candidate, Martha Coakley.
Although the Democrats don't seem to be having a very easy time getting a great candidate this time around either.
Well, they have candidates. The question is whether they'll coalesce around one. Now, Governor Deval Patrick will appoint somebody. It could be just a temporary placeholder, and then therefore it could be somebody like Michael Dukakis or Vicky Kennedy. Those names have been thrown out. Bad news to a lot of Americans out there. Ben Affleck announced this week he will not run for the seat. So
we're not going to have another movie star in the Senate.
Unless
in Kentucky, you know, there was talk about a movie star that they're running for. At least challenging Mitch McConnell.
That's
for his
right.
Senate.
But Ben Affleck said no. Ted Kennedy Jr. said no. It likely one of three Democratic members of the House will probably do it. Ed Markey, Mike Capuano, and Stephen Lynch. Those are three congressmen who are interested in that seat.
Okay, we're going to talk a bit more about John Kerry heading to the State Department. But first, let's see if we can get an answer to this trivia question about the last governor to run for the House of Representatives. We've got Audrey in Minneapolis. Hi, Audrey.
Hi, love the show and listen every week to Ken Rudin, but I'm going to guess Mitt Romney.
Well, Mitt Romney, he's a former governor, and the only thing he's run for since he's a former governor was president of the United States, and he didn't do too well in that. He did run for the Senate before he was governor, but he never ran for the House.
Okay, let's see if we can get one last try at the right answer here. We're going to go to Mike in Golden Valley, Minnesota. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So what do you think?
I'll go with Bill Janklow from South Dakota.
That is the correct answer.
Congratulations.
Bill Janklow was a four-term governor of South Dakota. When he was term limited in 2002, he ran for the House, elected to the House, and he resigned in 2003, by the way, after he killed somebody. He went through a stop sign, killed a motorcyclist. But Bill Janklow, former governor, who died in 2012, by the way, went to the House for one term.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike.
And Mike gets the T-shirt and the button.
And the button.
And, you know,
that coveted button.
He doesn't get the Neil Conan ding, 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 which is, you know, what every American is looking forward to.
Mike, just hold on the line for a minute and we'll get your information. Meanwhile, Ken, John Kerry moves to the State Department after a kind of difficult shuffling in the Obama administration, first trying and failing with Susan Rice. Where does this leave things now?
Well, of course, he didn't. Obama was basically, Susan Rice was a trial balloon, just as Chuck Hagel for the defense is a trial balloon. He had never nominated Susan Rice, but clearly she wasn't doing well with Republicans. And I think John Kerry, of course, some Republicans say, well, this will open up a seat for us. But mostly, he's one of the club. He's been around for a long time. He's also very close with Obama. Remember, as the presidential...
He played Romney in the practice debates.
I think he did, and he did better. And apparently he infuriated President Obama during the debates. But also, when he was the presidential nominee in 2004, it was his decision to have Barack Obama be the keynote speaker.
When Obama was relatively unknown.
That's right, and now he's very famous.
So you mentioned Chuck Hagel, the trial balloon for defense secretary. Talk about what happened with him last week.
Well, there's a lot of things going on with him. First of all, he was under the gun with gay rights supporters when he 18 years ago when James Hormel, who was President Clinton's ambassador ambassador to Luxembourg, Chuck Hagel said something like he opposes the nomination of an openly aggressively gay diplomat which wouldn't reflect American values. Well, the human rights campaigns, a lot of pro-gay rights groups were just outraged by that, said it's unacceptable.
They've come around in the last week,
and
but it doesn't sound like Hagel has the support that the White House necessarily needs.
Well, Hagel did apologize on the gay comment about James Hormel, but he still hasn't backed down for what Jewish group thinks is insensitive when he said that, you know, he's complaining about the Jewish lobby when it comes to Israel. And of course, a lot of Jews said, well, that should really be the Israeli lobby, not the Jewish lobby. And also, he refused to condemn or put sanctions on Hamas and Hezbollah, and a lot of Jewish groups were upset about that. And he also supported Barack Obama over John McCain, and McCain is not happy about that either in 2008.
Last thing, just briefly, the NRA had this very combative statement on Friday, followed by a tense exchange on Sunday morning talk shows. Backlash?
Well, there seems to be a backlash, but again, once again, you know, they once talked about we're going to work to solve a solution to this horrible, horrific shooting. Once again, another horrific shooting, this time in Newtown, Connecticut. There's a terrible tragedy. Something must be done. And then ultimately, the NRA saying we're not going to have a ban on automatic weapons. We're not going to have all these restrictions in there. Who knows what's going to happen?
All right. Stay here with us, Ken. Coming up, we're going to have a little more junkie. That is actually a little junkie. We'll meet Ken's mini-me in just a minute.
I am so dreading this.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Political Junkie Day. Ken Rudin with us, rain or shine, in today's case, sleet. And Ken, no scuttle button this week, but your fans can find this week's Political Junkie column, as always. It's about people in the political world who died in 2012, and that's at npr.org/junkie.
Speaking of dying, this next segment, I'm dreading this next segment.
Well, we have a special junkie treat for you, Ken. Watch your back. There is a new junkie in town, and by town I mean St. Louis, Missouri. Gabe Fleischer starts his morning at 6. He scours the internet for the political news of the day and drafts a rundown with all the information. He sends his newsletter out and then takes off for his day job as a fifth grader. He joins us now from St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome to the show, Gabe.
Thanks.
How'd you get interested in politics?
Well, I don't really know. It was in the 2008 elections, and I guess just so many people would talk about it.
When you were 7 years old.
Interesting enough. 6.
6.
Yes.
And where do you get your information from?
A lot of different sites. Politico.com, New York Times, Washington Post.
The Political Junkie column every week, I'm sure.
Yes.
Thanks,
definitely.
Gabe.
So how did you start doing this daily newsletter?
Well, I'm very interested in politics, but I find that a lot of other people get uninterested because of all the fights in Washington. So I wanted to inform people. And so I started with just my mom, and then...
She was your first subscriber?
She was.
And how do you get more subscribers from there?
Just friends of people who are on in a lot of different ways, and now 375 people read it every day.
Is Ken Rudin a subscriber? Ken, are you a subscriber?
I absolutely am.
You are.
I found out from him that Obama beat Romney. It was in his newsletter.
Gabe, you wake up before school to put this together every day. That seems like a lot of work day after day. Why do you keep doing it?
I find it's a lot of fun, and I love being able to inform people each and every day, and I love reading people's comments and their info, and it's very interesting to do it.
Okay, so what do you plan to do with this? Where are you going to go from here in the far future, say, middle school?
Well, some people tell me I get a little more homework, so we'll see if I keep on doing it. So
you mean if the masses insist that they need this to continue, you'll keep it going, but otherwise you may or may not.
Well, I hope I get to continue it, but we'll see.
Gabe, do you have any idols in the political journalism community that you'd like to say on the air right now? Any people you admire very much? Well,
Ken Rudin, of course.
Okay. That's all I need. Thanks.
Is it hard from St. Louis to track what's happening in Washington?
Not at all in this age. You know, there's political news all over the internet and newspapers and magazines. So
just give us a sample of, like, what was the top item in today's post-Christmas newsletter?
Well, I'm actually on a winter break right now.
Oh.
But I'll be back on January 3rd when Congress reconvenes.
All right. Well, we've arranged for a little contest between our two junkies, our resident junkie and our guest junkie.
Oh, no.
we're calling this Stump the Junkie, and we have asked you each for three trivia questions. So I'm going to pose the questions here, and I'll give you each an opportunity to respond to see which generation has the dominant junkie here.
You know, I'm twice his age.
I just want to you're 22? Is that so? Okay, Gabe, you ready?
I'm ready.
And Ken, you ready?
I am.
Okay, first question is to you, Gabe. You ready?
Yes.
Yes. Who was the youngest elected president?
That would be John F. Kennedy.
Congratulations. Well done. Okay, we've got 1 point for Gabe. Ken?
I'm losing already.
Who is the only president, this question comes from Gabe again, the only president with a PhD?
Jimmy Carter? Bill Clinton?
Oh.
Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yikes. Gabe, you want to give him the right answer?
It would be Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson. What did he have a PhD in?
Political science, I believe.
Of course. Okay, next question for you, Gabe. You're one for one so far. Okay, and this is a little tricky because you got JFK was the youngest elected president. Who was the youngest president?
Theodore Roosevelt, who took over when William McKinley died and he was assassinated, and he was vice president.
Bravo!
At the time.
I am very impressed. Okay, Ken.
Gabe, I gave you nice questions. I can't believe you're doing this to me. Okay.
All right, Ken.
Yes.
Which president lived the longest?
That would be Gerald Ford.
Well done. Congratulations. Okay, one for two. Gabe, back to you for your third and final question. And you may notice a theme here. These are all related to age. Who was the oldest elected president?
Ronald Reagan.
Well done. 3 for 3. Our young junkie has shown his stuff. And Ken, just to save face here, the third question from Gabe. Which president had the longest time between his last political office and his presidency? Of course, this doesn't count the presidents who never served in political office before taking the White House.
The
longest period of time between the last political office and the presidency. Oh, boy.
I knew this was going to happen.
I'm sorry. I'm glad I don't have to answer these questions. I just
seriously. My baseball glove, there was a hole in my glove. And I would have caught that ball, but there was a hole in the glove that...
Gabe, you want to give Ken a hint?
Gabe?
There's a...
One second.
Oh.
He's actually a very popular president, one of our best.
Oh, Nixon.
Here's another clue.
Okay.
There's currently a movie with the title of his name.
Oh, the guy who was succeeded Abraham Lincoln. Andrew Johnson.
Exactly. All right. Well, Ken, you got 1 out of 3, and Gabe with 3 for 3. I think does this mean you're our new political junkie? Have you just dethroned our junkie? It's been a pleasure having you on the show, Gabe.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
11-year-old Gabe Fleischer, editor-in-chief of Wake Up, It's Politics, giving Ken Rudin a run for his money, with us from St. Louis Public Radio. Gabe, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And since this is the last Political Junkie show of the year, Ken, let's take a look back at the political highlights from 2012. What was your top political moment from the year gone by?
Well, I would say, other than being humiliated by Gabe Fleischer, I would say that the election of Barack Obama, that sounds like a simplistic and obvious answer, but the fact is he went into this year with very high unemployment, with Republicans chomping at the bit to defeat him, with many polls showing that a lot of Republicans could defeat him, and yet somehow he just stayed true to his course. And while the Republicans were eating their own for the longest time, and even when there was the Republicans were somehow coalescing around Mitt Romney, Romney helped end his own campaign by
a lot of self-inflicted wounds.
A lot of self-inflicted wounds, starting with the 47%, to a lot of the comments he made during the debates. And ultimately, what happened was that that the coalition that had elected Republicans in the past, mostly white, were no longer the key to election. You had large amounts of Hispanic, women, gay and lesbian, African-American coalitions that Asian Americans that turned out into huge numbers. And while Mitt Romney, as all Republicans seem to do, won the white vote pretty handily, he overwhelmingly lost the other groups that I mentioned.
And Ken, is what we saw in 2008, in terms of that demographic shift, is that a permanent fundamental shift in American politics, or did the Obama campaign just have a better turnout machine with its base groups than the Romney machine had with its base groups?
Well, that's a good question, because, of course, you saw Obama put that coalition together in 2008, and then the Republicans came back in 2010 and won all those congressional seats. But there seems to be an understanding by Republicans that we can't win with the kind of dialogue and rhetoric that we've had in the past. And there are other Republicans, there are other faces. I don't know if it's just window dressing or not, but you see the Tim Scotts, the Mario Rubios.
Marco Rubio.
The Ted Cruzes, a lot of new voices, new faces in the Republican Party saying the old way may no longer work.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that tension between the old way that helped Republicans in Congress in 2010 and the new way that could be the path of 2012. There was one sort of quote that seared itself in the public imagination that captured some of the problems with what the Tea Party movement has done within the Republican Party. This was Republican Senate candidate Todd Akin of Missouri, who sparked a massive controversy with just a few words.
If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
Obviously, he lost that race. But beyond that, what did him and this year's election broadly say about the role of the Tea Party in Republicanism?
Well, in fairness, Todd Akin wasn't necessarily the Tea Party's choice in the primary. He got backed by Tea Party and other conservatives once he got the nomination. But I think what it did say about Republicans is that sometimes you have to compromise. Sometimes you have to look towards the middle ground. I mean, for all the problems people had with Dick Lugar and other moderates in the Republican Party, they were winners, and they didn't, you know, they won over and over again. But when you have nominees backed by the Tea Party, backed by conservatives like Todd Akin, against Claire McCaskill, who was ripe for the picking, when you had somebody, when you had Richard Murdoch in Indiana, who was a solid Republican seat, in 2010, when you had Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, a sure Republican pickup, when you nominate very conservative opponents, candidates, you hurt the opportunities for Republicans to reach out to the broad middle.
I mean, let's remember, this was a year when, by many accounts, Republicans were supposed to take control of the Senate, and instead they ended up losing seats. And yet we still see fewer moderates of both parties in the House and Senate now than we did before. When does this pendulum swing back?
Well, I don't know if it does, because you make a good point about the moderates leaving. The Democrats like Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson and people like that, whatever you think of them, they were talking across the aisle. Olympia Snowe on the Republican side, Dick Lugar in Indiana, who I mentioned. So if the moderates are leaving or the centrists are leaving and you have more and more conservative Republicans and more liberal Democrats, it's hard to make the case that anytime soon they'll be talking to each other, and we'll see what happens with this fiscal cliff argument.
Let's talk about one moment in the past year when there was a glimmer of bipartisanship. Just after Hurricane Sandy, this was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a surrogate for Mitt Romney and previously outspoken critic of President Obama. And here's what he had to say.
I have to say the administration, the president himself, and FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate have been outstanding with us so far. We have a great partnership with them, and I want to thank the president personally for his personal attention to this.
Okay, so Chris Christie, one of the guiding lights, bright future of the Republican Party.
He's the keynote speaker at the convention.
Keynote speaker at the Republican convention, offering a note of bipartisanship, which has been followed in the fiscal cliff talks by extreme partisanship. Of course, Christie's not involved in that. What do you see as the prospects for bipartisanship going forward?
Well, Christie said, look, when you have a terrible tragedy, as Hurricane Sandy was, you put politics aside and you do what's right for the state. And he got pilloried for saying nice things about President Obama. But the point is, this come right before the election. It basically drowned out, that's not supposed to be a pun, I didn't mean it that way, but, you know, blocked out all of Mitt Romney's comments. And basically the focus was on a president doing what a president is supposed to do. And it just so happened you had a Republican governor praising him. And by doing that, it just showed what President Obama can do, has done, and what he can do with the bully pulpit. And Mitt Romney was just, you know, just completely blocked out of coverage for days and days.
We've got political junkie Ken Rudin in the studio with us, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But Ken, how much of the prospect of bipartisanship has to do with just the map? I mean, Christie is a governor in New Jersey, which is a relatively blue state. Members of Congress in the Republican Party who are not reaching a deal with Democrats over the fiscal cliff in many cases come from districts that are so tightly drawn they are more at risk of a primary challenge from their right than they are of losing to a Democrat in the general election. So they have no incentive to be bipartisan.
Well, that almost seems like why the president seems to be looking at the Senate for the fiscal cliff negotiations. People like Johnny Isaacson of Georgia, who is very conservative and who may very well be faced with a Republican primary challenge from the right in 2014, because he is talking about we have to give a little to get a little. But there are some Republicans in their defense on guns, on taxes. It's hard to defend some things. But the point is they were elected. They said what they were going to do. They were reelected on that. And the fact is you have a Republican-controlled House that was elected on pro-gun, anti-tax sentiment. And they say, well, how are we going to just give up our principles in the name of bipartisanship?
Ken, let's talk a little bit more about the main themes of the political year gone by. I can think of so many catchphrases, whether it's binders full of women or horses and bayonets, that just caught fire on social media, which certainly existed before, but I never saw it have the kind of impact before that it had this year. Was this the year of the meme? How is social media changing politics?
You know, I think the first time we saw it perhaps was right prior to 2008. Well, first of all, Howard Dean talked about it for the longest time when he was running in 2004. And then we had George Allen, the senator from Virginia, who was likely to be a front runner for the Republican nomination in 2008 until a handheld iPhone took pictures of him.
I think it was before iPhones were available, but it was a portable video camera for
no,
sure.
I think it's on the phone. I think it was a video phone.
And the word was macaca.
Macaca, talking about that, and it went viral, and it ended his Senate career, and of course, ultimately ended his political career, as we saw this year. So we see more and more people not getting their news from the old standby TV networks, the CBS's, ABC's, NBC's of the world, or even cable, but a lot on the internet, a lot on iPhone, a lot with Jon Stewart, things like that.
Another big political landmark. In May, this president became the first in history to show his support for gay marriage.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
And Ken, this was a big year for gay marriage in other ways, too. The Supreme Court just agreed to take two cases on the subject. There were ballot measures that affirmed gay marriage for the first time by
ever.
A popular vote,
right,
for the first time ever. Where's the country going on this?
Well, it seems like, you know, I think Vice President Joe Biden started it off by saying that he sees nothing wrong with gay same-sex marriage. And remember, President Obama was very, very cautious. He was evolving. His mind was evolving about gay marriage. But then you saw at the Democratic convention, gay marriage was an issue that was celebrated for the first time at a convention. As you say, for the first time in popular vote history, same-sex marriages were passed by voters in four states, or at least three states plus another one where it wasn't rejected. And you had more gay and lesbian members elected to the Congress than ever before. It's the kind of thing that ultimately maybe it took decades much longer than it should have. But it seems like if you look at the polls, there seems to be a sea change in this country on issues like same-sex marriage that you wouldn't envision 10 or 20 years ago.
Okay, so Ken, a year ago it would have been easy to forecast the biggest political story of 2012, the presidential election. More of a challenge today, but I'm going to put it to you anyway. What do you forecast as being the biggest political story of 2013?
I think the biggest story is going to be the fact that this young kid, Gabe Fleischer, is going to be very, very ill, and he'll be unable to replace me on Talk of the Nation. I think
what
that's
a terrible thing to say.
No,
he's 11 years old.
I mean, his foot would hurt. I mean, his mother wouldn't let him come to Washington. I think that is an understated story for 2013.
The ever protective Ken Rudin is our resident political junkie, and he joins us here in Studio 3A as he did almost every Wednesday through all of 2012. Ken, it's been a pleasure having you, and we'll have you back in the new year as long as Gabe doesn't step
in. He doesn't have to be sick, just not feeling well.
Okay. After a short break, we'll return with New York Times columnist Charles Blow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.